Hello, and welcome to the Development Debrief with Catherine Van Sickle, the stories-based podcast that interviews donors, thought leaders, and professionals in the field of fundraising. This week, my guest and I explore the concept of academic research in the field of fundraising. We dig into donor motivation and ways in which research can help provide framework and clarity of thinking. Frontline fundraiser, researcher of donor inclinations, and status quo breaker, Anna Shalia is an expert in philanthropy research, principal and major gifts, program building, and executive leadership coaching. Relentlessly inquisitive about nonprofit institutions and the donors who support them, Anna is an emerging philanthropy scholar. She's pursuing a PhD at the University of Rochester studying philanthropy for higher education. Now let's get started. Hi, Anna. Welcome to the Debrief.
Hey, Catherine. How are you?
Good. How we met was so much fun. I think we should tell the story.
Well, we met at Mohonk, but we met because I came running across the room to you, claiming I loved your work. I loved the podcast, and I loved that people were talking about philanthropy and fundraising and using this medium, and you were just so damn good at it. So, yeah, I might have made a scene.
It made my entire day, but also that conference is just so special because I've talked about it before on the podcast, but it's an independent school conference at Mohonk Mountain House. And it's just really warm and it's a small group. And so everyone mixes.
Mohonk it's a beautiful location for those conferences. It's just so unique and it's definitely haunted. So when I said it, I had to push it out of my memory. I think that's why.
Oh yeah.
And I'll take a Marriott, you know?
Well, and of course, subsequently, you know, we saw each other at the CASE Summit. And I just want to mention that because there are really meaningful connections that can be built on kind of like the conference circuit.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that they were so missed the few years that they were on hold. Mm-hmm. I love a good Zoom meeting, but it makes such a difference to sit around and talk about big ideas, right? We're in the tactical so often that to be able to sit around and just like this conversation, the conversations that you host, to talk about why are we doing this or why are we doing things this way? And I think that happens, you know, it happens in the lobby, it happens at the restaurants, it happens at the bars.
Yes. And talking about the big ideas is so much fun, but it's even more fun when you're talking with someone like you who's informed, who has spent hours and hours and years researching. So why don't you tell us a little bit, you know, you have a practitioner's background in fundraising, but in the last couple of years, you've been consulting, but also doing research. So why don't you just tell us about how you came to do that and what you're focused on?
Yeah, thank you. I've been a frontline fundraiser for about 13 years in higher education. I did some other educational fundraising. But prior to all that, had my master's in institutional advancement from Vanderbilt, from Peabody College. And this was a small program within the higher ed administration program led by Tim Caboni at the time in the early 2000s. And he was really the one who identified for me this desire to amplify our profession and to support our profession as higher education fundraisers. He's now the president of Western Kentucky and remains a mentor of mine. So I went on to do my gift officer thing, road warrior, leadership gift officer, moved into major gifts, and then was managing a team at the Eastman School of Music, launched a campaign there, and then moved into consulting. And all the while, for the last few years, have been part-time working on my PhD program at the University of Rochester. And then just in the past few months, it's time to write this dissertation, time to write this little paper. So I'm in a library most days focused on this research, specifically my research on donor motivation. And I've had the lucky opportunity, and I feel so grateful to be able to focus, but also just to be spending time with fellow academics and pracademics is what we call ourselves, those who are standing on the border. They're boundary spanners between this academic research and frontline fundraising.
So I think let's take a pause for a second. I wish that we had a live audience so that I could ask people to raise their hands. How many people knew that there was an actual field of research in, you know, PhD level dissertation work in fundraising?
It surprises a lot of people, but it's been around. The study of philanthropy has been around for a long time. It's just cross-disciplinary in nature. So while you might have someone who wrote a book about annual fund 50 years ago from a perspective of, you know, maybe education or nonprofit management or public relations, you also now have neuroscience scholars who are studying brainwaves and generosity. So there's no true academic home for the study of philanthropy and fundraising, which is why, I don't know, there's great benefits of that. We've got all of these scholars in all of these different areas, economics, right, public relations. But then at the same time, we don't have that one association, that one conference necessarily.
Are there specific areas of focus within this research, or do you find that it runs the gamut, like you were just talking about all those different fields?
There's certainly segmentation. I mean, we find these special interest groups within some of the associations. Maybe I'll share with you the associations that are looking at the work that specifically impact higher education fundraisers. This is who I go to for my research, the sort of academic homes. And I want to first, if I may, back up and describe what we're talking about when we say research. So CASE, AFP put out some great research, right? They're studying a large group of fundraisers, or they're like the VSE examining their database of the voluntary support of education. So they're producing reports based on that data. Excellent research. We love them. Then we've got consultants and vendors. This is when you're seeing like the Pulse survey, or you know, you're seeing RNL coming out with different research studies. Again, they were examining maybe their base, their audience, and then producing research in that way. What I'm talking about, and my peers in the pracademic advancement space are talking about, is academic, peer-reviewed, empirical research. And so not one is better than the other. Not one learning is better than the other, but there is a commitment to the rigor of academic research, and also the processes which make it shine light, get out in the daylight, that I think is so important, especially for our profession, because so much of what fundraisers want is a legitimate profession. We want people to see what we do as not an art, right? What we do is not an art, I believe, but what we do has elements of science, and that's where the science comes from.
But you're not analyzing surveys, is what you're saying.
Right. So when I talk about research and the work that I'm working on right now, and those who I am reading right now, which include like Noah Dresner, Genevieve Shaker, recent work by Chase McNamee, Sandra Berenger, her work on trustees, these are all faculty members within institutions. Maybe they're part of a research lab who are not active fundraisers. Their job is faculty members who are conducting research.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is an important distinction. So exciting to hear that you chose donor motivation. What an amazing topic. How did you come to that?
Oh, a lot of researchers study donor motivation. It's very... It's very common. I think researchers, academics are just like us fundraisers. We want to know why donors do what they do, right? We're inquisitive about them. We want to know, what's up? Why did you make that decision? Why did you decide to come to that event? And so what I'm exploring in my dissertation research is high net worth, ultra wealthy donors who are supporting higher education with these mega gift donations that, you know, if you're a fundraiser, you're either looking in your portfolio to see who's the next mega gift donor. It's something that we're all interested in. These are the headlines that get shared around our office. These are the headlines that our dean comes to us and says, hey, wait, if this school just got 20 million, why haven't we gotten 20 million? So it's not just for the elites anymore. Mega gift donations are really having such an impact here the past few years. And I'm interested in what motivates those donors specifically to support higher education. And we assume, we think maybe that there are some different motivations at play than what the literature already tells us about donor motivation.
What
but
does
we
the
don't know
literature
yet.
tell us? And then what have you found?
Well, let me start with the framework that I really like, and I think a lot of people use as a basis for their research on donor motivation, which is outside of higher education. And then I'll talk about some research within higher education. So Beckers and Wiebking developed this framework for donor motivation in 2011. They did this huge literature review. They looked at over 500 studies from all these different disciplines of people who had studied donor motivation. And they essentially boiled it down to these eight mechanisms for charitable giving. And those include the first, always, is awareness of need. Does the donor even know that you're a nonprofit? Or if they know you're a nonprofit, do they know that you, maybe a big fancy institution, have a need? So the very first motivation for giving is awareness of need. The next is solicitation. We hear this all the time, right? People don't give unless they're asked. So solicitation as a motivation. Costs and benefits. This is going to be your very transactional donor. Maybe they're making a gift for that tax benefit or because of some benefit they receive. Next is altruism. We love these donors. Then reputation of the donor. I think we could put reputation of the donor, we could put a lot of, there could be a lot of conversation too around reputation of the donor as it relates to their link to your institution. And there's some good research on NCAA athletics that talk about a donor's connection to the institution and vicarious achievement. So make sure your sports teams are winning. Let's say reputation of the donor. Next, we've got psychological benefits. This makes me feel healed. This makes me feel whole. Philanthropy and giving back to my alma mater makes me feel like I am doing something good, and therefore I am fulfilling a psychological need, or, you know, I'm creating psychological benefit for myself. That could be a motivation. The next is values, value alignment. This is who I am. And then last is efficacy. So the donors who are motivated by how far their dollar will go. Now, that last piece on efficacy, there's some research lately that's questioning that a bit. There's also some research right now that's questioning the levels of how much trust has to do with motivation of giving. So their, you know, trust in the organization, trust in nonprofits to begin with. So going back to these eight mechanisms of charitable giving, this really provides a great framework for a lot of research. Now, since this has been published, there are a lot more studies that relate specifically to higher education that are identifying other motivations.
So higher education is different.
I would say higher education is an add-on. When we look at fundraising for sectors, we don't have the research that says why higher education is different. Not that I've found, maybe it's there, but I wonder, I'm curious about how higher education, fundraising for higher education, is different than your local animal shelter or food bank. I think we can speak to the role of higher education in society from an external standpoint, and our society, American society. And then also, I think we can speak to just how higher education really sets the pace for a lot of trends in fundraising. So there are a lot of things that universities do that then other nonprofits are watching. They're learning from innovation within higher education philanthropy.
So that's safe to say? It's safe to say that higher ed sets the pace?
I think so in some ways, and because it is so highly resourced. You know, development shops and fundraising shops within higher education are, it's not to say they're more sophisticated, but they've been around a long time.
Yeah.
We've been doing this since before we even got to this nation. We were fundraising for Harvard University before people even came over to the country. So, in that way, I
When
would
you put it
say there
that
are some
way.
unique characters. Yeah, we've been hired. Philanthropy has been around a while. We are part of a long, illustrious career.
So how have you found that motivation has changed over the years, or has it not?
I don't know if motivations have changed, but the way that scholars are examining those motivations has changed in a few ways. I would say the significant body of work from Noah Dresner looking at identity-based motivation, I think would be is a topic that has been addressed more. So this is studies that he's done, like unconscious motivation of your LGBTQ alumni, along with Jason Garvey. And this is an amazing article that every advancement shop should read, because it really speaks to the student experience of your LGBTQ alumni and how that motivates their philanthropy, how LGBTQ alumni are watching our institutions, and how they have these motivations that don't seem outright. They don't say, I'm giving back to the school because I had this experience, so this is who I am. They say that, but then when you look at their patterns of giving, it really does align with who they are and who they say they are. So I think identity-based giving is really important research in the past 10 years, and certainly more people are looking at it than Noah Dresner, but his work, along with Jason Garvey, is just, I think, really important for us to consider that our alumni base is never just one group, right? We can't just say our alumni. That doesn't work. We need to look at these individuals and their individual relationships. The other way that I think donor motivation literature is changing, as well as conversation that we are all having, is a focus away from the donor to some extent. So, Cassandra Chapman's research on the charitable triangulation theory, what she's saying is that you have to have three entities when it comes to a gift. So imagine, Catherine, your spreadsheet. Imagine you're the last gift you brought in. There are three actors at play there. You, your donor, and the beneficiary. And that there are didactic relationships within there, and there are tridactic relationships within there, that there are so many components that are happening between those three entities that influence whether a gift is made or not. And it's never just one person. And it's never just two. You're never going to be, your success as a fundraiser is dependent on so many factors. Yeah,
Right.
you can be a badass fundraiser, but it really depends on all of these other scenarios. And so what she says is that while there has been all this focus on donor motivation, it really takes a lot of information out of the picture, especially the beneficiary. And I'll say more about the beneficiary. This is why we do what we do. This is why we chose this profession, is because we care about, I mean, I'm going to assume we care about the future of higher education in our nation. We care about the research that is produced at these institutions, to benefit society. Like, this is the keeping the beneficiary focused is something that academics are moving towards. And we see that within ethical decision-making frameworks. And we see that within now this motivation giving rationale frameworks. And I'd love to start seeing that movement in our work. So there's quite a bit of research on what makes a good gift officer and what are the traits and characteristics. And I would point anybody and everybody to the work of Genevieve Shaker. She's done a lot of research on fundraisers and also on fundraisers' relationships with donors and how there really is a continuum of that relationship. And there are gifts at every stage. There can be gifts at every stage. You can have a very transactional relationship. You can also have a relationship where someone's coming to a concert every other week. And they're very much invested in the institution, in the programs that they care about, and also you. You are the one who made the relationship possible. I think it's just a degrees of relationship. But I think the second we say, I am a representative of my institution, like we're not robots. That's absurd.
I think it's a really fine balance because there are things that I would say in a meeting that maybe I wouldn't say with a group of friends and vice
Oh, yeah.
versa. But at the same time, I'm still being myself. So I think it's
Yeah.
that line that maybe some newer fundraisers are still navigating.
Oh, it's a really tricky line to navigate. And I think so much of how we learn to do this work is trial and error, being around other fundraisers. This is the great work of Pace McNamee, which will be coming out soon. And it's his research on how institutional advancement officers, gift officers, fundraisers, advancement shops learn. And so much of it, we do it the hard way, don't we?
I so agree. It is learning by doing. You can read about it, but every donor, every case, they could be having a bad day. There could be something that came out in the news that day. I remember I had a prospect visit the day after presidential election. Would have been really different a week prior, right? So all of those factors are important.
There's a report that came out of probably a decade ago now about the curious chameleon. So some of the traits that
Yes.
research indicates for frontline fundraisers is that they're emotionally intelligent, they're curious, and that they also can be process oriented. So it does require, and we all know this, requires that balance of being able to engage with the right people in the room at the right time and then have the appropriate follow-up. And I think that there's fundraisers who just fall across that spectrum and they all have varying degrees of success, or they are all successful, regardless of whether they are the huge personality or they are just there to raise gifts and you could replace gifts with any other sales job.
So we've talked about skills of fundraisers. We've talked about motivation. Do you have a few other standout studies that you think could help listeners elevate fundraising results or just that you think are really interesting that we should know?
The researchers that are really important to our profession, I would say, are Noah Dresner, Genevieve Shaker, Chase McNamee's work on knowledge, Sandra Berenger's work on trustees is phenomenal. The Sandra Berenger and Carly Rife article recently on trustees was phenomenal. It really created this framework for who these people are and how they interact with our institutions. And so they talked about individual trustees as either facilitators, supporters, or patrons. So facilitators are that get. They're the ones who are the boundary spanners. They are they are meeting with people, their peers, and introducing them back to the institution. They are soliciting gifts. Supporters are I call these the Shakira board members, wherever, whenever. Like they don't care. It's just if the president comes to them and says, okay, today it's data science, tomorrow it's going to be God knows what, that wherever, whenever. These are the board members who are in it to support the institution. They understand that there's a minimum giving requirement. And they're going to be excited by what we put in front of them. And then we have the board members who are the patrons. Think of like patrons of the arts. They have a very specific, probably entry point to become a board member because of a department, a research center, even a specific professor or an issue or a cause at the institution. And so their motivation for giving is going to be around that specific focus, whether or not it's in your campaign, right? Like that's something we come up against. So I want to pull back and use this example real quick to say any chief advancement officer, senior director of development, anybody in our world would say, yeah, of course, that makes sense. Those are the three categories of trustees, right? How does that influence what I do? I think with all of these research studies, what it does is provide a framework and a clarity of thinking that allows us to step into it as professionals and say, okay, cool. Three. So if I've got these three types of trustees, they might need different levels of communication. They might need to hear from other people. Maybe that patron really just needs to hear from the dean and not from the president, because the patron just really cares about the dean of the program that they care about. Having these frameworks that dictate our behavior and our decision making only elevate our profession. Now, so much of it is instinctual, especially when we look at that donor motivation research. I think I'm pretty good at this. I'm sure you're great at this. We could walk away from a donor visit and say to ourselves, ooh, this person is going to want their name in lights. But you're not going to sit and think, ooh, this person is really motivated by reputation and reputation within the community. They also, looking at Michael Wirth's research, they really care about impact of the institution, but not really in impact of, the cause itself. So it's not that these frameworks and these way, this knowledge is going to change your intuition as a really great gift officer, but it just amplifies it and clarifies it. And I think if we all walked into some of these meetings and said, what is this donor? What really motivates this donor? It's going to clean up your next steps when you get back into the car and you start doing your voice to text contact report.
Yeah, I was hearing you talk about that was reminding me of some work that I did. This was a previous episode on retreat and culture work with the team. It gives you the language.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, that's why that makes sense, because it's this thing. You know, my guess is that most fundraisers have a pretty good gut instinct. Hopefully they have a pretty, like you said, with the EI, you can pick up on those things. But then the categories do help your brain make sense of it.
Right. And we know that there's patterns of behaviors and patterns of motivations. And so understanding some of those through this literature, I think, can help us dictate our strategy and our next steps. So one thing to mention, too, is that all of this is available to all of you, that if you are at a university, you have access to the library. But this is just a one easy search away, and you're going to look for things like the Philanthropy and Education Journal. You're going to look for Lilly School of Philanthropy and the Sadaka Lab at Teachers College, and searching up Genevieve Shaker and Noah Dresner, and certainly like the Association for Research on Nonprofit Organizations and Voluntary Action, which is our NOVA, is a large nonprofit conference. And the fundraising research that a lot of the scholars there are focused on absolutely translate to our work. So this is all free. This is all available for you.
Thank you for helping us know how we can tap into this. But for someone who's brand new to it, where do they start? Do they start with a specific gift case and try to find the theme related to that? Or should they just start with reading some of the favorite researchers that you've mentioned?
I could do either one. I've probably left off about 10 of my favorites. So no, I think Google Scholar is fun to play around with. Fun as hell to play around with. If you've got
been a while since I've done that.
Yeah. No, I think it's when you're stumped. I think it's when you're sitting around, 4 minutes before you're one-on-one with your boss and you have to talk about next steps with somebody. And you're like, oh, there's just something about this donor that I'm not getting right. Or man, they're really not budging. I'm missing something here, right? We all have to be honest with ourselves to say I'm missing something here. I think that's when you go to Google Scholar, and maybe you can look at athletic motivation, or give motivations for giving to athletics, or search around to find some of this research. Lilly School of Philanthropy does a tremendous job of translating their research, but really fundraisers in higher education, y'all are smart. You can get through an abstract. You can read through this research. There's not so much of it that is super heavy quantitative research that is intimidating, I think. Mm-hmm. And so just a way to dive into it to, again, help frame what you already know or help challenge your thinking a bit.
So it can be as simple as Googling some keywords.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's a great place to start.
Yeah.
On my LinkedIn, every once in a while, I've been trying to post articles that excite me. So if you wanted to give a follow, and I'm
So are you
desperate to
open
research articles.
to people reaching out to you if they're listening to this and they're
Oh,
really excited?
absolutely. Absolutely. I'm
Great.
happy to talk about this research, point people in the right direction, make any introductions that I can, and also know that there's a large group of these pracademics that's that colleague of yours that's in a master's program. Find out what they're studying. We know that a lot of the dissertations that study institutional advancement by advancement practitioners, maybe going to school while they're fundraising, never see the light of day. And it's just so disheartening that this knowledge never gets out there, it never gets published. And so there's a great group of us. We're a pracademic squad. We meet on Zoom every once in a while, and it's folks who are getting their EdD or PhD, and they're in an advancement office right now. And so many of them are studying fascinating topics like retention of alumni relations, gift officers. One woman is studying chief advancement officers' leadership styles and how that impacts major gift fundraising. We've just got a great group of folks. So yeah, I'm happy to be a connector and happy to talk to folks and not be by myself in the library.
Thank you. Thank you so much for bringing this to light. As you said, they're not seeing the light of day. Well, maybe they will now. This is great.
I hope so.
What do you know for
That's
sure,
great.
Anna?
Thank you. What do I know for sure? I love this. I know that our work matters. And I know that's a Miss America answer. But I know that our work matters. And I also know that sometimes it's hard to see, and that we have to do the work as higher ed advancement folks to take those extra steps out of our offices, onto campus, into a research talk, into a student group, and really see for ourselves how what we do every single day matters to the students and to the life of the university and to the research. And so I know that the work that we do is so critically important, and our profession is so important. And I think research only supports our profession.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your work.
Hey, listeners, it's Keith from Evertrue. Evertrue unlocks the potential of your entire donor pyramid. But how? Why, by giving fundraising teams the tools they need to personalize outreach at scale. Wow. And to inspire fundraising teams along the way, we offer Evertrue Studios, advancement's very first media hub. Evertrue Studios is like Netflix, but for advancement. And we publish new podcast and video content every week. It's all free and all created with fundraisers in mind. Subscribe for weekly content from the Development Debrief podcast and other advancement thought leaders at evertrue.com/studios.